Yeah, no, I saw. Yeah.
It's one of the things we used to sell.
Sometimes I'm happy.
Call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order here. We are starting off the session on a punctuality note, so we don't have very many people here, including our honorable Dr. Warner. Today we have an informational meeting on the tax expenditure report and revenue impact estimation methods. Right. So we will.
Can
open
I say one thing before we do that, Madam Chair?
Oh.
I wanted to point out that we did you did agree to adding a major issue on capital gains for the work plan, and that's in front of the committee.
Okay.
So you've got a modified work plan you've already adopted, so I just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
So.
All right. Now if I can figure out how to get my paperless system open, I'll figure that out later. Okay. We will open the informational meeting on the tax expenditure report.
I'll be right back, Madam Chair.
Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Craig Fisher. I'm the research manager for the Department of Revenue. With me is John Hart, who is a senior economist with our research section. And what we'd like to do today is provide you with some background about the 11-13 tax expenditure report, provide you with some background information about the report generally, and some hopefully some tips to make this a useful resource for you. I'll give you a little bit of context about tax expenditures generally and how they're applied in Oregon, and then John will discuss some of the revenue impacts in the report, and then I'd like to give you some illustrations of the requirements of the report and the ways that we can use the book to its fullest. So the general concept of tax expenditures has been around for some time. The federal government has produced tax expenditure reports since the late 80s. Most states produce them in various forms. But the general concept behind the tax expenditures that is a provision of tax law that imparts some special treatment to groups of taxpayers. And the term tax expenditure derives from the sort of economic equivalence of foregoing revenue from some of these special provisions. That it is, could be the same thing as receiving that revenue in the first place and having a spending program in place. So the tax expenditure concept really relates to that equivalence, if you will. In Oregon, the requirement to produce a tax expenditure report derives from the Budget Accountability Act, which was passed in 1995, requires the governor to produce a tax expenditure report and report to the legislature with the recommended budget. The language in that statute indicates that these tax expenditures are similar to direct expenditures and that the tax expenditure report will allow tax expenditures to be debated in conjunction with online budgets. So again, the context generally as well as this specific Oregon manifestation is that these are considered the equivalent of spending through the tax system. Oregon has a specific statutory definition of tax expenditure, and it is really quite involved. I won't read this, but I will point out a couple of highlights from it. It indicates that any law of the federal government or the state, which is it's a very broad definition, and it includes those provisions of federal law that we connect to in the definition of taxable income. So any of those provisions, deductions, and exclusions that are or selected deductions and exclusions at the federal level are also Oregon tax expenditures through this definition because of our tie to that federal definition of taxable income. I'll also point out that it is a broad definition in terms of tax programs as well. Although most of the tax expenditures are in the income tax and the property tax programs, the book actually involves 17 tax programs. So there are various tax expenditures sprinkled throughout some of these other tax programs, the fuel tax, the cigarette tax, and various other programs. So it's a very broad statutory definition of tax expenditure. To give you a little bit of an indication of kind of the nature of tax expenditures, I think it might be useful to sort of see the rough categories that they fall in. We have 378 tax expenditures in this book, and slightly more than half of them are in the income tax program, both individual and corporate. A little more than a third of them are in the property tax program, and then there are 38 scattered in these other 15 tax programs. So in just in might be helpful, this is actually how the book is organized, but if you think about the provisions in the income tax program, the first two categories here, the federal exclusions and federal adjustments and deductions, are related to our tie to the federal definition of taxable income. So income that is not considered taxable source at the federal level, there are 66 of those. There are 55 adjustments and deductions. And so there are about 120 of that 217 derived from that connection to the federal definition of taxable income. If you go to the next level here, the Oregon-specific provisions, there are 28 Oregon subtractions, 61 Oregon credits, and seven other provisions. Just some examples of the kinds of things we're talking about here. The exclusions relate to transfer payments or public assistance payments, employer-provided medical payments, those items that are not considered taxable sources. Adjustments and deductions include itemized deductions for charitable contributions or mortgage interest or IRA contributions. When we get into the Oregon subtractions, examples of those include the subtraction for federal income taxes and subtraction for contributions to college 529 college savings plans. And in the credit area, there are some credits that apply to individuals exclusively, some to corporations, and some apply to both. Examples, the earned income credit, the film production credit, and credit for contributions to the Oregon Cultural Trust. So just as a reminder, the difference in the context between these provisions is the exclusions, adjustments, deductions, and subtractions really reduce the amount of taxable income to which rates are then applied. The credits really are a one-for-one, a dollar-for-dollar trade-off against tax liability. So there's a little bit of a difference in the nature of those. Relating to the property tax provisions, of the 123, most of those are cases where property is fully exempt from taxation. There are a number of cases, such as the strategic investment program or historic property, where only a portion of the property is exempt from taxation. And then there are 12 provisions that where there is special, the property is specially assessed. Farmland and forest land are good examples of that, where there's special treatment in the way that there are assigned values. And then of the remaining 38, there's just a variety sprinkled throughout those tax programs. One other way to look at the types of tax expenditures is to sort of think a little bit about the nature of the expenditure itself. And a number of these, so I'll try to give you about four categories of ways to look at the expenditures in addition to this sort of tax system view of it. The first is that a number of these provide economic incentives to encourage specific taxpayer behavior, which is distinct from providing financial assistance to certain groups of taxpayers. Okay, and these distinctions can be useful when you're thinking about sort of evaluating whether these accomplish their purpose or not. It's useful in determining what the intent of the tax expenditure is. There are some tax expenditures that are simply prohibited by federal law. Federal property, for example, is a type of property that can't be taxed under the property tax system, so it's kind of a specific category. And then there are a variety of other types, and some of these include policies to simplify or reduce the cost of tax administration. One example of that would be personal property for personal use. Household items, clothing, those kinds of things are not taxed under the property tax system, in part because of the difficulty in valuing and administering a property tax. So hopefully it's useful to sort of think about the various types of tax expenditures that are included in this book. So John's going to give you a little bit of background now about the revenue impacts of the expenditures.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Hart. I'm a senior economist at the Department of Revenue. This slide gives a breakdown of the estimated revenue impacts compared to the estimated revenues by tax program for the tax expenditures. The first category, income tax, we have, based on the December forecast, estimated revenues of about $13 billion, and the estimates of our tax expenditures in the tax expenditure report come to about $12 billion. of that amount, and we have slides coming up showing that these are concentrated amongst the top 10. But of that amount, about $8 billion comes from our $8.5 billion comes from our connection to the federal definition of taxable income. For the property tax program, our estimates for the 2011-13 biennium show revenues of about $11.2 billion coming in during the biennium, and revenue impact from tax expenditures of about $19.1 billion. And again, that's highly concentrated, and we'll show a slide on that. The other tax programs are showing estimated revenues of about $3 billion with the revenue impact of tax expenditures of about $155 million.
So basically, to explain that, we roughly give out half of the revenue we take in through tax expenditures. We take in $13 billion and we lose $12 billion through tax expenditures. Am I understanding that correctly for the income tax?
Madam Chair, the revenue that is actually coming in is $13 billion, and there are provisions either excluding or providing credits that cost about $12.1 billion, so a little less than half. This next slide shows that the top 10 of those account for about 64% of the total estimated revenue impact. The three highlighted items here are those that are purely the result of Oregon law. The other items are the result of our tie to the federal definition of taxable income. So the largest of the personal income tax expenditures is home mortgage interest. That's a deduction. The second largest is the personal exemption credit, one of the last things on the Oregon form. And employer-paid medical benefits is third largest. That one is an exclusion that doesn't show up on the tax form. And the rest of the top 10, again, the total is about 64% of all income tax expenditures. So about two-thirds comes from just those 10 items out of the 217 tax expenditures for income tax.
On the personal exemption, how do other states do this? Is this pretty much a common exemption that states use, or what do they use in its place?
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with many other states. However, at the federal level, the equivalent would be the standard deduction. I think that part of our standard deduction has been converted to the personal exemption credit at the back, and I'm not totally familiar with the history on that.
Paul, maybe you could elaborate.
I do think, Madam Chair, that the majority of the states treat exemptions like the federal government does. They have an amount that is like a deduction that you can, depending on the number of dependents you have. So most of the states, I think, follow that kind of federal standard. I don't know. I can't think of any others that use a credit for the exemption. And this was done. This goes back to the 1980s when the legislature converted to a credit, because we used to have a more standard treatment.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. For 2011-13 on the property tax expenditures, by far the largest property tax expenditure is the exclusion of intangible personal property from the property tax, and that would include things like bank accounts or 401ks. We have a statute that exempts those from our property taxation, and that's over half of the total in property tax expenditures. The next one is federal property at about $2 billion federal property we cannot tax, and that's about 10%. So just between those top two, we have about two-thirds of the total revenue impact for property tax expenditures. And you can see for these top 10, about 93% of the revenue impact is represented out of 123 property tax expenditures listed in our book. Now I'd like to go over some of the things to keep in mind as you look at the revenue estimates in the book. One item is that the estimates are static estimates. So if we see an increase in, say, film credits, the film credit estimate is just the cost of the film credit. It doesn't take into account any additional income tax that may be generated by stimulus effects or any of those economic feedbacks. There's potential for interactions between expenditures, and so each expenditure is reviewed individually. But if one of the expenditures were repealed, then maybe somebody would increase another expenditure. So, for instance, if a property tax exemption were taken away, if a charitable property tax exemption were taken away from somebody, maybe that's a farm, and then now they're eligible for a farm special assessment or something like that. And so one of the reasons we give a warning about adding up the totals on these, even though we do it and share them, is that if you repeal these one by one, they may actually kind of be, the slack may be taken up by different provisions. The revenue estimates listed are different than the potential yield from repealing the tax expenditures. I mentioned some of the issues with the interactions, but there's also such issues as carry forwards, or some credits are meant to be taken over time, and so a repeal wouldn't necessarily eliminate those aspects, and so the revenue impact is different than the potential yield. And with property taxes, we report a loss. If a property is exempt, the exemption amount is reported as a loss. And for bonds, we also report, not just bonds, but any fixed levy, we also have a shift. A lot of bonds in the state are paid based on a fixed dollar that needs to be raised. And so as you lower the taxable value that is being used to raise that fixed dollar amount, then the rates have to be higher on properties that are non-exempt, and that's what's reported as the shift. And we would also like to emphasize, and this has been true probably every time the book's been published, but we're in the middle of kind of rapidly changing economic and revenue outlooks, and so the estimates in the book are based on the December forecast, but with new forecasts, the estimates are subject to being different.
In terms of helping you make the most of the publication, I thought I'd discuss a little bit about the required information that each of the tax expenditures that the statute asks the governor to provide. We have to provide the statutory authority for each expenditure, identify or state the purpose, which isn't as straightforward as it might appear. Of the 378 tax expenditures that we have, slightly more than 30 actually have explicit purpose statements included in statute. So there's a later when we talk a little bit about the evaluations, that's sort of a key element that identifying what the specific purpose of a particular provision is. A lot of these simply exist in statute, and the purpose can be inferred, but there's a small number that have explicit purpose statements in statute. The report must contain revenue loss estimates, as John was describing, for the current biennium and the subsequent biennium. It's required that the report be organized by budget program or function, and so we have assigned as many tax expenditures as we can to the program categories that fit the budget categories, so education and natural resources and human services. So as I'll talk about later, part of the book is organized in that order, so they're grouped by that particular program or function. It must contain a description of who benefits, and I'll give you an example a little bit later, but wherever possible, we try to, on the income tax side, provide as much detail as we can about the claimants of credits, for example, or the taxpayers that use the specific provisions. Where we have individual income tax data, for example, we even try to provide some distributional information about the claimants. The report must contain an evaluation that really has two components. They are to be evaluated according to whether they achieve their purpose and whether or not they're the most fiscally effective means of accomplishing their purpose. I'll talk a little bit more about how that is done, the process for establishing those evaluations, but that linkage again to that purpose statement is really quite important, because if the requirement is that they accomplish their purpose, the importance of a clear purpose is, it is important that it has a clear purpose. And in some of the cases, as we were talking about the categories, in the case of prohibited by federal law, for example, it essentially accomplishes that by definition. It's prohibited, and so it's not taxed. So that evaluation is really more relevant for particular tax expenditures. And then finally, the governor provides recommendations about whether to extend provisions that will sunset in the next biennium or whether to recommend that they be allowed to sunset. So that's the requirements of the report. In terms of a couple of tips or some information on how to use the report, it might be useful to know that there are sort of three indexes in the report that can help guide you through these 378 expenditures. The first is really listed by tax program. If you recall that first table that steps through the income tax provisions, the exclusions, and the adjustments and deductions and subtractions, that's really the organization in that table one. It steps through the provisions in that order. There's another index on page 21 that sorts these by the budget program and function areas. So you can find all of the education expenditures, for example, in one place across all the tax programs. All the natural resource expenditures are in one place. So it's just a different ordering, if you will, a different index. And then finally, there's a keyword index on page 409 of the book that if you know the name of an expenditure or a word that's in the title, that can help you find where that expenditure is in the book. So those three indexes, I think, are useful in finding specific expenditures. And then the book is organized according to 17 chapters, again, each chapter corresponding to a tax program. Each chapter begins with a description of the tax. So it's a useful way to understand a little bit about the base, the from which the expenditures deviate. And then the detail for each of these expenditures is provided. And I gave an example of one of the pieces when we talk about the who benefits. This is an illustration of some of the distributional information that we provide for some income tax provisions. This is the political contribution credit. And we essentially provide for five... We break this into full-year taxpayers and part-year non-resident taxpayers. Essentially, the way to read this chart is there are about 1.6 million full-year taxpayers, in this case, in 2008. And of those, about 124,000 claimed the political contribution credit. And that represents about 7.8%, and then the average credit was $68 per return. Similarly, for part-year and non-resident filers, there were slightly more than 212,000 of those. Slightly more than 5,000 claimed the credit, which is about 2.4% of the total for an average of $61. And so that detail is provided, and it's broken down by income levels as well. So for where it's possible, we try to provide that distributional information about the claimants of these credits or other income tax provisions.
You said the mean credit, most of those are over 50, so you must be looking at joint returns.
Madam Chair, that's correct. This represents the filers, which in some cases can be married filing jointly. So it's more of a household concept than it is individual taxpayer.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I will briefly touch on what the Department of Revenue's role is in producing the tax expenditure report. The first thing that we do is identify and describe new, modified, and deleted tax expenditures. We produce estimates of the revenue foregone by these tax expenditures. And then we play a role in coordinating the information flow among agencies. The Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Office and the Governor's Office to facilitate the evaluations. So the idea behind the evaluations is that either the subject matter specialists or agencies that have program responsibility are the folks that conduct the evaluations, and the Department of Revenue provides information and acts as a facilitator of information flow in that process. So you'll notice in the, if you look at the evaluations in the report, it's actually specified which agency conducted the evaluation, so that information is there. So just to summarize, the tax expenditure report provides detailed information about Oregon's tax system. So the report can provide you with the foundation of each of these tax programs as well as the expenditures that relate to them. The tax expenditures are reported together with the budget because of the similarity to direct spending. And the report is the result of the work of roughly 30 agencies. As I described earlier, this evaluation process involves quite a few state agencies in conducting those. It's not exclusively budget management and Department of Revenue. And we would appreciate any feedback that you could offer about the usefulness of the publication or anything we can do to improve it.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? It's a lot to digest here. This has been the insomnia cure for as long as I've been around here in legislature, but it's very important information in here, so I appreciate it.
Can I add something, Madam Chair? Just to link this up with the process that you're starting this session with the tax credit sunset review process. Of course, you're all members of the Joint Tax Credit Committee. What we're getting calls from committee administrators that have the bills that you introduced, and they're onto a policy committee with a subsequent referral to the joint committee. And this is what we're basically recommending. This is your starting point, is the analysis that's done here. These are evaluations are to be undertaken as part of the tax expenditure report by agencies. Now, admittedly, and I'm sure Craig would agree, there's quite a bit of variability in the extent that analysis takes place. Some agencies have really put in a lot of time and effort in trying to gather information, others less so. But that's a good starting point, I think, in that process. So the committees, this will be the first thing they'll be looking at when they start to take up those bills.
And do you all have any recommendations on what other guidance we can give as a legislature to make sure that there's a connection between the tax credit or the tax expenditure and the benefit to the taxpayer who actually at the end of the day is paying for them? Have you given any thoughts to that?
Well, Madam Chair, just in my observation of developing the report and working with agencies there, the more clarity there is around the objective of the tax expenditure, the easier it is for the agency to consider that when they're evaluating its effectiveness. There's also a question of I believe the reference to, is this the most fiscally effective means of accomplishing the purpose? There's a question about, is the tax system the appropriate vehicle mm-hmm. with which to accomplish this purpose? So once, there's essentially a couple of steps, I believe, that to identify that this is a worthwhile objective, but then given that, is the tax system the appropriate mechanism to deliver that, or is there a spending program, or just a basic consideration of that effectiveness? Because in some cases, for example, there are certifications. There are agencies that are involved in certifications and have direct contact with individual recipients, and then the linkage to there's a direct linkage there with the participants. That becomes less so when it becomes involved in the tax system, particularly if there are credits that are transferable. It's not necessarily the direct recipient then that's showing up in the tax system. It may be a secondary source.
I wonder what program he might be referring to.
We'll yes. look into that, Madam Chair.
Yes, yes. I'm actually at that page right now.
What page number?
183. Yeah, because we're struggling with, and we'll be struggling even more as we go down the line to really try to true up what the benefit of the tax expenditure is to the taxpayer and trying to quantify some benefits so that we can tell. Do you have any thoughts on how you can get this notion of other methods of achieving the same purpose, or do you think the review of that is already adequate? You said whether the tax code is the best way. Do you have any thoughts on how that can be made stronger?
Chair Burdick, I do think that for the most part, when you're comparing these provisions to direct spending, it really is the subject matter specialists and the folks with program responsibility that have the direct knowledge of how that lines up with their specific spending program. So I think the more tightly connected those are, I think would probably be a good thing to think about.
As a general matter, what are your thoughts on when, just as a general matter, when you should use a tax expenditure versus a direct spending? What are there any general rules of thumb that people use or that you think make sense?
Chair Burdick, I'm not sure there are any general rules, I think, that I can think of. I'm sorry.
Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might offer one. This equalization of the tax return, putting people in equal positions, for instance, exemptions. If you've got no children and this person has three, should you be paying the same amount? It's pushing more towards net disposable income. Somebody's got high medical expenses, somebody else doesn't. I mean, that's the federal tax code has been built a lot on that, trying to equalize positions, disposable interest, disposable income, whereby you can pay the tax.
Okay. So that's one criterion. But then when you have the incentives where you're
right.
Not trying to equalize, but you're trying to encourage one thing or another.
Behavior, right.
You know, because it has been brought up in connection with some of these tax credits, wouldn't it make more sense to just give them the money rather than, you know, have them go through the tax credit? If it's transferable, there's a transfer cost to that. Wouldn't it be more efficient just to give them the money? And we will be struggling with that. And I'm probably not being fair to put you on the spot on that, but you're here.
One of those would be cash flow. You know, in order to subsidize, if we were to subsidize solar industry, giving them cash versus just taking a credit is a lot different. I mean, there's a major cash flow problem there.
Correct. But
that would be another reason sometimes credit would be better than actual cash, to answer your question.
If you need cash flow, why would a credit be better than actual
because
cash?
Because the state's cash flow.
Right. Oh, I see, the state's cash flow.
State's cash flow.
Yes, and I think that's probably a big part of it. Senator Morse.
I think the principal reason is that there would be very few grants out of the Treasury for whatever the purpose is if you had to actually put it in as a line item expenditure. It just wouldn't happen.
And
if it wouldn't happen in that circumstance, should we do it by virtue of a tax credit? And that's kind of a policy issue.
It's more transparency by actually making
right,
a grant.
Right, transparency, which now we do it by virtue of a tax credit, but the bill doesn't come due for a while, the cash flow issue, and it's forgotten.
Well, and it's also the money never comes through the door. Once the money comes through the door, you're dealing with a different environment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
I concur with Senator Morris. It's like paying cash at a restaurant or at a store when you're pulling cash out of your wallet versus handing your credit card. There's a psychological thing that the dynamic is a greater magnitude, but I agree these things wouldn't get funded. They just wouldn't get funded because we don't give the same scrutiny to expenditures like this that we do to actual outlays. On the transfer issue, what's the upside or downside of limiting the cost, the discounts, so that Walmart or whatever investor buys at a discount price one of these tax credits? What if we say, is there any way to limit that? Do other states have different ways to try and rein in that cost or give the state more bang for its buck when it administers these expenditures?
Mm-hmm. Chair Burdick, Senator Hess, I'm not familiar with how other states I don't know about the degree of transferability of credits in other states, so I'm not sure I can speak to that directly. There are a number of provisions that, in terms of limitations, some of the property tax expenditures have sort of opt-in, or they have cases where it's necessary to have a majority of districts approving a particular property tax exemption, for example. So there are, I think, some existing examples where they're controlled in some way, or some of the credits have upper bounds. They have a maximum amount that can be certified for the credit. But I'm not sure I can speak to how other states relate to transferability of credits.
Chair.
Senator Hess.
I think this came up in the torturous Betsy discussions. Maybe Paul can address this. But Paul, what if we just said Betsy or whatever, you can't pay less than 90% discount on this, or 10% in that case.
I'm not sure which torturous discussion you're referring to, Senator Hass, but there were many, yes. I'm sure there'll be many more. But we have looked at the transferability issue, and it is, there's a couple things about the Betsy in particular. One is, you've got the cash flow issue, but it's really the cash flow issue on the other side. If you have a startup company or companies that have losses, then, they don't have a lot of value to a credit currently, and it's not helping them get the capital they need. So I think it's been seen as a source of getting capital to the industry to get it started. That comes with a cost, and what that's through the transferability, we've had a large discount in order to attract people, but also because of the timing of it. The Betsy is over a five-year period, so you have a discount there that you attract people through that mechanism. There's no question that it does add to the cost. It reduces the amount of state dollars, if you will, that go directly into that particular activity you're trying to encourage. So there certainly is a cost and efficiency issue that can be raised there. We've looked at a couple things. One is the feasibility, and we've talked a little bit with the Department of Revenue about this, but the feasibility of a refundable credit, which would be a more direct way to get those dollars to the particular activity. But that, of course, would have a more immediate impact on the state's revenue stream. So a refundable credit would be one way to avoid those kind of transactions costs.
Do you have some thoughts on that?
Chair Burdick, Senator Hess, one of the, I think, motivations for the transferability is to allow nonprofit or public entities to take advantage of the credit where they wouldn't have a taxable liability. So by transferring the credit elsewhere, I think that's one of the reasons that functionally exists.
Senator Telford.
Are you done?
And thank you. And as you mentioned that, the Internal Revenue Code, based on the healthcare pieces that have now, nonprofits now can get refundable tax credits. For the health insurance, they can actually file the 990T, which is usually taxable income. They can now get, that's now a channel to get the money, the cash for the credit. So, we can consider something like that instead of a pass-through, because that's what it's doing, is the nonprofits are doing, they're passing it through to somebody who is profitable and getting, taking advantage of the tax credit, whereas if you gave it to a nonprofit, one not paying tax, but allowed them to get the tax credit, such as a 990T is doing with the feds, would be an approach to take.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Apologize for putting you on the spot on a couple things, but appreciate your coming forward with this very clear presentation. And we will be getting a copy of this presentation. And for those of us who are trying to go paperless, I assume it's available electronically as well.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just in that regard, we everything that you have in front of you for the committee, exhibits, we're putting on the S drive. Julia has been putting all of that out there under Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. So you should be able to find all, you have access to that, should be able to find all of the material there.
Great.
So we're trying to follow our directives and reduce our paper production.
All of our offices are trying as hard as they can to keep up with these S drives and things. So Thank you. We'll all get through this.
Kind of a Where's Waldo thing.
Yes, exactly. I can't tell you how many times I've had to text my staff to find out where on the screen I can find it.
You're making me feel better.
Okay, what's next, Paul?
Madam Chair, we actually originally planned this as a three-part discussion around methodology with the tax expenditure report, and then a review of kind of our forecast process. The forecast folks are up in Portland today. Chris just got back, and they're reviewing some of the assumptions for the February 15 release. So we asked them to come back next Friday and kind of talk through the methodology that they're for the forecast process before you get your actual numbers on the 15th. So there's been some questions about, you know, how this is done and who, you know, where the information comes from, that kind of thing. So they'll be able to address all those issues with you on Friday. So we're going to go to the third part of this and should be able to let you go early today.
Well, we always appreciate that. Yes. And you're sure you don't want to bring Chris up here and see if we can get a sneak preview?
Well, actually, I'm going to ask Chris and Mazin to come up because they're going to... you know, for any questions you have about the revenue impact analysis, they may be able to have more insight than I do on some of those issues. But what I've done is just put together one page for you summarizing the revenue impact analysis, what we do, what the kind of guiding principles are, what are the key elements, and so forth. So I'll just walk through this with you real quickly, and then just feel free to stop at any point you'd like to ask more detailed questions. if you're like to refer to the statutory authority, it's under 173.025.2, 173.025.1 is the fiscal impact and the legislative fiscal office. The guiding principles, one of the things that came up during the interim with the allotment reductions from for Department of Revenue is, well, there was a risk of a revenue impact. And how does that get into the system? Well, one of the reactions in terms of our revenue impact analysis, we don't do a revenue impact unless we have a bill. I mean, that's clear. That's what our statutory authority is. So when you have a change like that, or let's say you have a federal law change during the interim or even during the session, it was not associated with a state bill, all of those will be incorporated into the forecast informally. It'll be one of the factors that the state economist would take account of when he's making underlying assumptions for the analysis. So in the case of the allotment reductions, consulted with Department of Revenue, what was the anticipated impact of that, and then that was built informally into those assumptions underlying the forecast. So if there is, of course, a bill before you, even if it doesn't have to be a revenue bill, it can be a budget bill that in many cases does affect Department of Revenue and their enforcement and compliance efforts or their resources, then we will write a revenue impact for that. We also limit our revenue impacts to direct impacts rather than something that is indirect, so that... that means that if it's a direct impact on revenue or the revenue system, then we will write the impact statement. If it's an indirect effect, let's say that the only example I think of, let's say that you're going to raise the minimum wage, and because the demand for labor is elasticity is less than one, you're going to increase total wages. Therefore, that's going to increase income taxes. Now, that's kind of a convoluted argument. Maybe some truth to that, but we wouldn't include that in revenue impact. It's
wouldn't
too indirect.
The
secondary effect of the minimum wage, raising wages, therefore increasing withholding and increasing revenue.
Why wouldn't you include that?
Because it's an indirect effect. It's not a direct effect.
Okay. So take something like the film credit.
The film credit would be similar.
So
we would not, there's two reasons for that. One is the indirect. Two is the causality. Did the film investment occur because of the credit? Well, we don't, and there's no states that do this, feel that the evidence is strong enough to detail enough to be able to assume a causal relationship between the two. And obviously, you have to take that into account to make a judgment about whether you think this is something worth doing. And there's information that the film and video folks will show you on what the impact of the industry is, what the employment is. Those kinds of things we'll include in our impact statement, but we won't include potential revenue that may come from increased economic activity as a result of that.
And same with the business energy tax credit.
Same with the business energy tax credit, yes. Now, I'll get to the exceptions under methodology at the end here, but those are direct versus indirect. The other thing I'll say that we do don't limit our revenue impact statements to things that just have a number on them. We will include them if we see them as part of the revenue system, like a tax compliance bill or something that may impact the system, or in many cases may shift funds around, you know, shifting how the cigarette tax is distributed. If there's a bill like that, Madison would likely write a revenue impact saying it shifted from cities and counties to the health plan or something like that. The statute also makes it very clear that we are to do revenue impacts on not only state but local governments and explicitly for school districts. And, of course, that's where we've traditionally spent time through the school district formula, where there's a change in that formula. Doesn't affect the overall revenue to schools, but it does affect the revenue to going to individual districts. Another thing that we often ask about early in a session is, well, how can you have a fee and not have a revenue impact? Well, we, for narrowly defined fees, we think it's just more efficient to do that through the budget process where the fee is associated with some type of expenditure. And so the LFO, when they do their fiscal impacts, will incorporate that. So that's how we pick that up. And actually, I think it's a better way to make sure it's built into the budget and tracked. So those are kind of the guiding principles that we use. Of course, I go through every one of the bills and determine whether it's a no or a potential. And when it's a potential, then I'll assign it to each of our economists or myself. And so they'll go through and make the final determination. And sometimes they'll, even if it's a potential, they'll say it's a no or a minimal based on their analysis.
What's the threshold or minimum to go beyond the
minimal?
Minimal.
Well, there isn't a dollar amount to this, and we've talked a lot with the fiscal office about this. There's kind of an urban legend out there that it's 50,000, but
that was Ways and Means.
That's what I'm talking about. We've talked to them about that fiscal minimum, and that's where it should go, to Ways and Means. Basically, some of it has to do with the precision about whether it's minimal or not. If we knew that the impact was $5,000 for some reason, some explicit thing, and we knew that's what it was, we would put that in there. But if it was, we thought theoretically it'd be a small amount, but we don't have a way to precisely know what that is, then we'll put it in. So we don't have a dollar limit on that. We also will call some of them indeterminate, and by that, what we mean is that it will affect the revenue system, or will potentially affect revenue, but we think that the sign could be either way. Could be positive or negative, and objectively looking at it, would have a mean of zero. So it could be positive, could be negative. The outcome is likely to be not significantly different than zero. So that's what our indeterminate means. A couple of things about the impact statements. They're always based on current law. And that's where we get into the sunset stuff that we've talked a lot about. There's been a lot of discussion around kind of going further in the future for budgeting. We think we've been a little bit ahead of our brothers and sisters on the spending side, because we have tended to go out two biennia ever since I can remember in terms of the impacts and also in terms of your current law revenue forecast. So we have that base out there, and we will continue to do that. And actually, we could expand that further if it's something that would be helpful to the policy discussion. The other things that we have that we've added just last session was a little box on all of the statements that says if a bill does the bill extend, expand, or create a new tax expenditure, yes or no. So, and that's kind of part of this whole sunset review process and tax, emphasis on the tax expenditures and their impact on the budget. So those are kind of the key elements and the methodological issues. Craig Fisher was saying about the tax expenditure report, our initial estimates are all static, meaning that they don't have the potential behavioral effects in them. And that's pretty standard across most, I think just about all the states do revenue impacts in that way, and the federal government does as well. We do make exceptions in areas of what we call partial equilibrium analysis, where we know enough about a market to know, to be able to quantify behavioral effects and do it in a supportive way. And a classic example, cigarettes, because we have enough data, we've got mounds of data on cigarettes, and so we're able to determine what would be the likely effect of a tax increase, which, in other words, a price increase on consumer behavior. Mazin will use an elasticity for gas tax estimates. Again, same thing, you've got a well-defined market and a lot of information about consumer response. The last thing I'll say is about the large systemic effects. And this is an area where we do diverge from what most states do. We do incorporate a form of dynamic analysis into those measures with substantial, which we feel like have the potential to substantially affect the revenue system and therefore to influence the flows of labor and capital.
Can you give us that, for instance?
We have, of course, I think the best use of this analysis and where it does make the most sense were the kinds of scenarios that you were looking at in the comprehensive revenue restructuring task force, where you would look at, okay, what if we were to impose a statewide gross receipts tax of X amount and reduce the personal income tax by X amount? How would that affect the relative attractiveness of ARC? Mm-hmm. And so we have a computable general equilibrium model that allows us to do that. Most states don't do that. California did for a while. California was very helpful. Department of Finance and helping us construct our model, they've since gone away from it. I think primarily because the people that did it have left. But we've had this model set up for over 10 years now. The other areas, there are some specific areas where we've used it. The move to the single sales factor, for example, was a sufficiently large enough change in our revenue environment. Basically, when you go from a three-factor formula for apportionment to a sales-only, you're going to basically, theoretically, a consumption tax. So we wanted to incorporate that impact, and we tried to trace through, and it did have, in our model, significant impact on, particularly on different industrial sectors.
And that's been in for a while. How did your predictions stand up on that one?
Well, they stood up very well in terms of the shift in the industrial mix of who's paying the tax. And you can really see that. In fact, we'll have next week, Department of Revenue released their new annual corporate income tax summary numbers. And that shows you the corporate tax base. And we can show you that compared to 10 years ago. Basically, the sectors that have moved to the forefront are wholesale trade, finance, and retail. Well, that's what you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
So those predictions. In terms of the revenue itself, we can actually go back. Department of Revenue can allow us to go back and impose a three-factor formula now and see what the difference would be.
Okay. Senator Hess has a question.
Madam Chair, I was just going to comment. California had the single sales tax factor on their ballot measure
In
November. They have it in the vote. The question was to repeal it.
Yes.
And it was defeated. Pretty
yes, that's true, Senator. But you know, the way they incorporated it was kind of odd, in my opinion.
California.
Even for California, no, they had it as you got to select, so it was a choice. So companies could choose either way, and that was, I think, a lot different than the way it was implemented in other states.
So it's right now, because the ballot measure failed. Right now, it's a choice.
Well, that was the law that passed, was a choice, and that's what failed. So I guess they went back to the previous law.
So it remains a choice. That's interesting. All right.
So that another example, of course, that you have on your work plan is capital gains, where we would see as a significant enough change in a broad group of taxpayers that may affect the flow of resources in and out of the state. So that would be another area where we would do that. What we found with these feedback effects are, because we're talking about these flows regionally, we think they're gradual in their impact, and they're not something you immediately see in the system. Now, there may be some examples where that's not the case, but that's our assumption about how resources respond to those kind of changes. So you'll be seeing a lot of these, and so we just wanted to give you a little bit of background, give you a chance to ask any questions you had about how we actually do this.
Any questions before we move to our esteemed panel?
I think they're just here for your tough questions.
Just here for
see, they're only the tough. I'll handle the easy ones.
The no smoking in bars revenue impact, was that because of systemic change to the revenue system? Mr. Mazin?
Madam Chair, for the record, Mazin Malik with the Legislative Revenue Office. I think you're referring to the Clean Indoor
Correct.
Act, right? And the change, the impact for that was primarily because you would get to a point where laws of this kind or another have been seen to be successful or partially successful. And in that sense, we assumed it to be slightly successful, not too successful. And we thought that this kind of law will slightly reduce smoking. But when you reduce smoking, we took it away by, I think at that time, if I recall correctly, that the reduction was one cigarette a day per smoker, I guess, or something of that sort. But that makes a big difference, of course. So the evidence have shown that usually it actually is bigger, and it seems like the effect has come to say we were just right in the ballpark. So we're happy that we really kind of paid attention to the evidence in front of us.
Yeah, the smoking thing is very tough because you can cut down on revenue from lottery sales, you know, on a temporary basis, but then there's really no system for factoring in the savings on health care. That's kind of an example of the limitations of the system we have.
If you, Madam Chair, that's true. If you had a single payer for the health system, and then that single payer experienced less expenditures because of healthier individuals, then you could account for that. But since that is not part of the things that you are looking at, there is probably no enough correlation, nor is it one per one temporally, meaning it's in this year. I mean, the improvement in health could occur 10 years down the line.
Yet another argument for single payer. I don't think I have a consensus here.
I wouldn't do a revenue impact statement on that one.
That's all right. I'm just trying to put pressure on you here. Okay. Anything else, Paul? Yes, or questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I think we're done for the week. And Monday we have we have the CPAs coming. We're going to go through a detailed discussion of ReConnect. Chris has put together some numbers that he shared with the House Revenue Committee. We'll have those to go with you in detail. And we have the books from the CPAs and the ReConnect. And there'll be three from the society here to walk the committee through those changes. So you have an exciting Monday.
Yes, and our intention is to move a bill very as quickly as possible for the 2010 Connect issues.
Retroactive.
Retroactive, so that taxpayers who are now trying to figure out what to do will have some guidance, right. And hopefully we'll be able to save some of them from having to do amendments. Also, committee, we had a big lecture from our president about the importance of punctuality. So I am on a punctuality rehab kick. So we're going to be starting on time. I asked, since there is only four of us, if we just get started on time. We're down to three meetings a week this session, so we've got to, you know, use our time as productively as we can. And so I'm going to be starting on time, and if I slip, I know I can count on at least three people here to get me back on track. So with that, we are adjourned.